identify yourselves and be heard. I won't read the list. There are seven or eight who've asked to make appearances.
My name is Eric Janis, Your Honor. I'm here to speak in favor of the rules and present them to the court on behalf of the commission which drafted them. Thank you.
In mind that there's potentially seven or eight appearances, I hope you'll be as concise as possible.
Yes, Your Honor, I will attempt to be. Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court, my name is Eric Janis, and it's my pleasure to present to you the proposed special rules of procedure governing proceedings under the Minnesota Hospitalization and Commitment Act. I'm here in place of Dean Richard Allen, who was a very, very able chairman of this commission and also the commission, the study commission appointed by the Supreme Court to study the mentally disabled and the courts. As you know, Dean Allen is in Swaziland consulting right now and, of course, was not able to make it. If I might just very briefly tell you about the history of these proposed rules. They are the result of a four-year process of hard work and study by a great number of people. The first stage began in 1977 when Chief Justice Sharon and the Supreme Court appointed the Supreme Court Study Commission on the Mentally Disabled in the Courts. Dean Allen chaired that committee. It was a commission of 33 members, including six psychiatrists, 14 attorneys, including five judges, attorneys from the county attorney's offices throughout the state, the attorney general's office, as well as other attorneys involved in the mental health process, several institutional officials, including the director of a large state hospital, representatives of a number of organizations, public officials from the legislature, both lay and professional advocates, psychologists, journalists, and so forth. Geographically, it was representative of the entire state. The commission held six public hearings around the state, engaged in several in-depth factual studies about the commitment system in the state, involving surveys to judges and county attorneys, and studied the procedures in 12 counties in-depth in the field. The final report of the commission was issued in July 1979 and contained 24 separate recommendations. In December 1979, the Chief Justice appointed a rules commission to draft rules of procedure to implement those recommendations. Again, the rules commission was a very representative group with three judges, a probate court commissioner, a county attorney, an assistant county attorney, three psychiatrists, three other lawyers, and a patient advocate. Six of these people were from outside of the metropolitan area. This rules commission met over 20 separate times over an 18-month period in the process of drafting these rules. Our goal was to draft rules which would implement the commission's recommendations faithfully, but always with the knowledge that rules of procedure must be practical and encourage efficient use of judicial and other resources. Now, I suspect that some who come here today to object to some of these rules may well warn that some of the rules will result in added expenditures. They well may. Others, such as the pre-hearing screening rule, may well save money by diverting people into voluntary treatment in the community. Money, of course, is important, but I urge the court always to keep in mind that the focus of commitment hearings is the liberty of individuals. It is a difficult job to balance the interests of efficiency and practicality against the value we place on liberty. If it were not difficult, there would have been no need to appoint two commissions to spend 4 years to develop recommendations and rules. These rules, which we've presented to you, we believe represent a very deliberate and considered judgment about how and where to strike the balance between efficiency, practicality, and the protection of individual liberty. If I might, with the court's indulgence, I would like simply to mention the purpose of each of the rules. I don't plan to spend a long time about it, to say maybe two or three sentences about those about which there may be some controversy. Would that suit the court? There are 15 rules. Rule 1 contains the requirements of the petition for commitment. It simply states that the petition must state facts and must pray for a certain disposition. Rule 2 is entitled Summons and Apprehend and Confine. In this rule, the procedure for commencing the commitment procedure and obtaining personal jurisdiction over the proposed patient or respondent, as they're called in the rules, is set out. A summons procedure is to be used unless there is a showing of imminent serious harm, in other words, that imminent serious harm is likely, or unless the respondent has not appeared pursuant to a summons. In those cases, an ex parte apprehend and confine order can be used to bring the respondent into the hospital for an examination and for the hearing. Rule 3 deals with the provision of counsel. As you know, under the law and under the Constitution, counsel must be provided to persons who are subject to commitment hearings. Under this rule, the court must assure that adequate counsel is made available at every critical stage of the process. Rule 4 defines the role of the respondent's counsel. The study commission found that there was a great deal of variability and lack of uniformity on the role of respondent's counsel. This rule makes it clear that the respondent's counsel is responsible to advocate vigorously on behalf of the respondent, to follow the articulated instructions of the respondent, except in cases involving tactical or strategic decisions about how to run a trial. This, we believe, is the traditional division of responsibility between client and attorney, and it's the kind of division that is reflected in most areas of litigation. We believe it should be reflected in the commitment area as well. Rule 5 deals with access to medical records. It provides for an exchange of medical records between the parties in the commitment. It authorizes the court to authorize the respondent's counsel to have access to medical records in third parties' hands, and it provides for sanctions for failure to comply. Rule 6, probable cause hearings, is our attempt to implement this court's recent decision in Doe versus Madonna. Provides very basically that there must be a probable cause hearing within 72 hours of a person being taken into confinement, excluding Sundays and holidays. There must be a showing of imminent physical harm, and provides that hearsay evidence and other informal procedures are acceptable at a probable cause hearing. Rule 7, appointment of examiners, provides a procedure whereby the respondent can recommend one of two medical examiners to be appointed, and the court must appoint one of those recommended if that person is qualified. Rule 8, the examination of the respondent by the medical examiners. The major provisions of this rule are that the examination must take place not more than 7 days prior to the hearing, but at least 2 days prior to the hearing, and the examiners must prepare a written report to be submitted to the court and counsels 48 hours prior to the hearing. The reason for this, of course, is to provide counsel notice of the contents of the examination so that they may prepare for the hearing. Rule 9 deals with pre-hearing screening. As you know, anyone may file a petition for commitment. The purpose of pre-hearing screening is to screen out those respondents for whom it is clear that there is that there are not enough facts to commit them, to divert as many persons as possible out of the involuntary treatment which results from commitment and towards voluntary treatment in the community. And thirdly, to determine what is the least restrictive form of involuntary treatment, if indeed that is necessary. Rule 10, location of the hearing. I believe that this is one of the rules which may cause some controversy. The study commission recommended that hearings not take place in hospitals, but take place in courtrooms or in courts. Believing that the respondent would benefit from an awareness of the seriousness of the process and the separation, the visible separation of the judicial from the medical treatment process. The Rules Committee spent many hours debating this. There were concerns raised about the inefficiencies and costs and of transporting patients from the hospital to the courthouse, we reached, I think, a reasonable compromise. The rules provide that hearings should take place in courtrooms, but that courtrooms may be in hospitals. The rules then set forth what we consider to be very minimal standards for courtrooms in hospitals. Just basically, the standards are that there must be some physical separation between the treatment area and the courtroom, sufficient room to separate the parties and participants in the hearing, and room for the judge, for the lawyer and client to meet privately. Rule 11, presence of the respondent at the hearings, simply provides that any waivers of the right to be present must be knowingly and freely made. Rule 12, disposition, spells out the burden of proof. One other of the controversial provisions of the rules is in Rule 12, in which the, I believe, Rule 12.04, which states that the court, if it finds that there might be some alternative to involuntary hospitalization that would be suitable for a particular person, but that for one reason or another this alternative is not available, the proposed rule provides that the court may order the joinder of a governmental agency, if there is one, that's responsible for providing this service, and determine whether to direct that the service be made available. Now, I know that there'll be concerns raised about separation of powers so forth in connection with this. However, if I may, I'd like to point out that there are judicially enforceable rights to services. This court has enforced such rights in the past. In the case of certain welfare services or social services, they're clearly enforceable by the courts. It is not inconceivable and not uncommon for people to be sent to the hospital because governmental agencies do not pay for services in the community. Our feeling is that it's most efficient to have the committing court review whether or not there is a legal right to those community services, and if there is, make the order so that unnecessary hospitalization can be avoided. Rule 13 deals with indeterminate and extended commitments and provides for a hearing before a commitment is made indeterminate. Rule 14 provides for the service of certain documents upon the respondent, and Rule 15 defines the role of the guardian ad litem in the commitment process. With that, Your Honors, I would conclude and urge the adoption of these rules. I will be available, as well as a number of the other members of the commission, for questions if there are some.
The Rule 4, I believe it is, deals with the obligation of the lawyer to provide vigorously for his, unless that's a very long rule. Would you read that in its text?
Would you like me to read the rule, did you say?
Yeah.
Sure. It is actually a fairly long rule. It extends for two pages. Tracks the provisions and the recommendations, yes, sir. It provides for vigorous advocacy, advising the client, of course, about what the likelihood of success is and so forth, exercising professional responsibility.
Well, does it, and the intent of the rule is that counsel is to vigorously resist commitment?
If that is the desire of his client, yes.
Regardless of what he may view as the interest of his client.
That's right, Your Honor. That was the recommendation of the study commission. That was, yes, what we implemented.
Would you comment on the suggestion made by some that the rule should not be implemented because there's legislation pending?
Yes, Your Honor. There is legislation pending. The legislation does address some of the same issues as the rule. The two pieces are not coextensive by any means. The rule goes into some areas that the legislation doesn't, and vice versa. For the most part, the two are consistent. Proposed rules are consistent with the legislation, although there are some changes, a few changes that would have to be made in the rules if they were adopted and the legislation was subsequently adopted. I don't believe that we should wait for the legislature. This bill was introduced last session. Nothing was done on it. It may go somewhere this next session. It may not. There's been a lot of work put into these rules, and I think they're in good shape, and I think they ought to be adopted. minor changes might be necessary if the laws are passed as proposed.
Thank you, Mr. Janis.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard in support of the proposed rule? If not, we'll hear from others who have reservations or are in opposition or wish to comment on any particular aspect of these proposals. Judge Harlan Nelson has requested an appearance.
Members of the court, my name is Harlan Nelson. I am the county court judge of Clay, Becker, and Otter Tail County with Chambers and Fergus Falls. And I appear here this morning on behalf of the Minnesota County Court Judges Association. Appearing with me is Judge Peter Lindbergh from the Municipal Court of Hamilton County. Our association was acquainted with the proposed rules at the juvenile judges meeting in September. And at that time, Judge Ring, who is a member of the study commission that proposed these rules, brought them to the attention of our association. We discussed them briefly, had an opportunity to go over them briefly. And our association at that time directed that the committee from our Judges Association on Commitments and Institutions study the proposed rules and report back to the County Judges Association at its annual meeting scheduled for December 3rd, 4th, and 5th. It is anticipated that the County Judges Association will discuss the proposed rules and take some action on those rules at their meeting in December. And I've been asked to appear before you today with the request that the court not take any action until such time as the county court judges have had an opportunity to review the matters and to take some official position, which we anticipate will be done in our annual meeting in December. So our request is not that you adopt them or that you do not adopt them, but that you simply give our association an opportunity to review them, to discuss them, and to take some official position, which we can then convey to you to advise you as to how the County Court Judges Association feel regarding the proposed rule. At this time, we have not had an opportunity to adequately review them, to study them, or to take an official position on behalf of our association. Thank you.
Mr. Harry Kramer is asked to be heard. Mr. Kramer here. There has also been a request by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and I'll ask the representative, please, to come forward and be heard.
Justices, my name is Jean Gerval. I appear here on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Our association first was cognizant as a general membership of the rules on September 9, 1981, when they appeared in the Northwest Reporter System. We have discussed the rules at a board meeting, which was held on September 25th of this month. But our board at this time is unable to take any kind of substantive position or any position as far as the substantive nature and quality of the rules. We simply have not had adequate time. Would like the opportunity to be able to refer the substance of the rules back to a committee that we could appoint through our association for further study. We do have, we do request that this court delay implementation of the rules. We feel that there are some problems that have to be addressed. First of all, we're very concerned about the fact that there is pending legislation in this area. We think the rules do diverge from the existing statutes. That there's pending legislation right now in House File 1499, and we're unaware of what the final outcome of that legislation will be. We'd like the court to delay implementation of the rules so we don't have the situation where the rules are much divergent from the statute that's eventually passed.
Counsel, yes. Judge Nelson had indicated, and I think a very reasonable request, that the county judges have an opportunity to study this and indicated that they would have a report and would consider it 3rd, 4th, and 5th of December. I'm wondering if if the County Attorneys Association in their request has thought time-wise and with all due expedition to consider this and what kind of time do you need?
We would have the opportunity to possibly appoint a committee to study the rules at our next board meeting, which would be tomorrow, and present their position to the general membership at our annual meeting in November. So we would be able to bring back a County Attorney Association position on these rules.
Counsel, is it my understanding that part of what your organization is concerned with is coordination with the legislation?
Yes.
In so coordinating that legislation, it would be helpful to me, if any report you make back, to keep in mind that legislation deals with substantive law. The judicial branch of government deals with procedural rules, and sometimes there is a middle gray area that we coordinate so we don't get fuzzy on whether it's substance or procedural, but legislation on procedural matters is a matter of comedy as to whether you go along with it or not.
We are concerned about the fact that, and I think this would be something that would come forth in the eventual County Attorney Association stance, that perhaps there is more going on in the rules than just procedure. I would also like to point
Counsel,
out that...
It probably should be mentioned, maybe in that vein, that the legislature has, of course, granted or passed enabling legislation in the field of evidence, in the field of civil law, in the field of criminal, giving the court the right to promulgate rules. So I don't know exactly the full implications of that, but it appears that the legislature has given their sanction to the court, or their permission to the court to draw rules.
Your Honor, the County Attorneys Association is fully supportive of the court establishing procedural rules in the area of mental health commitment. We recognize that there's a need for those rules, and there's a need for reform and a need for uniformity. We are concerned, however, about these rules. We'd like to have more time to study them, and we'd have more time to see what the outcome of pending legislation is going to be.
When would you anticipate that there would be action on that legislation?
It was introduced last session. I understand that there's a possibility of something happening this session. I would like to point out that in a comment to Rule 9, it indicates the County Attorneys Association has voted the approval of pre-petition screening. We've searched our membership long and hard and can't seem to remember doing that, so I think that would be an error within the draft of the rules that you have presented to you. I would further ask that in the study that's done on the rules, further study that's done either by this court or by referral back to the commission or the committee, that the impact of these rules on the outstate areas be fully considered. I think there's a number of problems that have arisen on first blush or first contact with our association in the impact of these rules on outstate areas. There's lots of distance between doctors and hospitals and courtrooms, and we would ask that that be fully considered before the rules be adopted. I have nothing further.
Thank you. A representative of the Ramsey County Attorney's Office has asked to be heard, Mr. Harry McPeak and Kim Bingham.
Please the court, my name is Harry McPeak. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney. We have submitted a brief to the court and hope it is of some assistance in this matter. I'd like to comment on a couple of matters which we believe to be of more important than some others. We would join in the court's request to the court to defer action until the legislature completes its review of House File 1499. We do not envision this to be an open-ended matter, but if the legislature declines to take any action, we would not suggest that the court defer indefinitely. The bill was introduced late in the session. It's been referred to committee, and we would expect and hope that there would be some action on the bill early in the session. At the worst, the legislature adjourns in May, and that would be the outside parameter of the delay requested. I would like to respond to Justice Todd's observation about the gray area between substance and procedure. I think the dilemma that we see, Your Honor, is that it's not entirely clear that the rules deal solely with procedure, and the proposed legislation perhaps doesn't deal solely with substance. Perhaps if the court
it might be helpful to cut what we've done in the past to avoid that problem, just to get the legislation to enable the thing, which Justice Scott points about, then you eliminate the problem in that gray area, because what they've done is really granted substantive authority to the court. And that's why the civil rules came about, the criminal rules, because there is that problem. It exists. And the easiest way was to coordinate it.
And I think absent that enabling legislation, Your Honor, we would end up with that dilemma. Would like to address specifically two of the rules. The first is Rule 7, which deals with the appointment of examining physicians by the court. It appears from comment, or note one rather, to that rule, that the rule is based upon what the commission felt was the suspect appearance of the proceedings in the probate courts. We would like to state that is not the experience of this office, and we reject that as a characterization of the probate procedure. It is our feeling that the procedure outlined in the rules would lead to a battle of experts, and would be likely to be less assistance to the trier of fact than the current procedure. The rules of evidence envision that experts are called and used to assist the trier of fact. It's our concern that with a petitioner's doctor and a respondent's doctor, that the position of both would be predictable, and that neither would envision or see him or herself as a court-appointed or neutral examiner. We feel that the present practice of neutral examiners maintain rather than subvert the integrity of the judicial process, and in fact are likely to be of more real practical assistance to the court. There may be some time problems in the examination processes outlined in Rule 7 and 8 if private practitioners are used in the time frame set forth and the rules are mandatory. It's our concern that hospitalizations of confined patients are likely to be much longer than they currently are to allow for the examinations within the time frame set forth. I would ask that the court consider that. The other matter which we would like to address specifically is Rule 13, which deals with the 60-day hearings. Our concern is focused on two areas. The first is the mandate that examiners be appointed in each case. We certainly would not suggest that the probate court be deprived of the opportunity, if it was appropriate, to have the patient examined, take whatever steps appear necessary for a fair and just resolution of the case. We don't feel that a retrial of every case at the 60-day hearing is warranted and is in the best interest of the public. We think that the probate court, in reviewing the matter, would have an opportunity to determine whether or not reexamination was appropriate, and that matter should be left to the sound discretion of the trial court. A practical problem posed from a petitioner's point of view is that the rules require that we essentially reprove the petition by clear and convincing evidence. In most cases, in this sort of a situation, the patient will have been in the hospital for the entire 60-day period. It's difficult to understand how we can prove that the patient is unable to care for his needs or provide for his needs if they've been in the hospital for that whole period. And yet under the present rule, the same elements required for commitment would be required at the 60-day hearing. We feel that a proposal that provides for judicial review at the 60-day hearing, but is perhaps more consistent with the realities of the situation, might be that for the court would review the 60-day report, and if it reaches a determination that the decisions of the hospital are medically reasonable, that the burden at that point legally would then shift to respondent, and it would essentially become a point 19 hearing under which respondent has the opportunity to petition for a finding that he or she is no longer mentally ill and in need of hospitalization. We feel that this would reduce the use of doctor's time and court time, and yet would provide for independent judicial review of the 60-day reports. And we feel that the objectives are achieved, but in a more streamlined fashion that does not prejudice the right of the respondents. Thank you.
Is there anyone else from the County Attorney's Office, Mr. Bingham, wish to be heard?
I'll be the only one speaking for that office, Your Honor. Thank
you. Very well, thank you. Is there anyone from Judge Glenn's panel who wishes to be heard? There are nine persons on the panel, and they have noted some reservations, have not asked for a formal presentation, but if any member wishes to be heard, they're welcome to step forward. Otherwise, we'll proceed. Yes, Mr. Williams. Mr. Charles Williams.
My name is Charles H. Williams, Jr. I'm one of the nine attorneys who serve on the Ramsey County panel. I didn't realize that Mr. McPeak was going to take the position that he did take in regard to the cutting short, if you will, the rights of persons subject to the commitment process. I'd just like to say a few words, first of all, in regard to the rights of proposed patients. There is a need for the respondent to have an opportunity to at least select one of the proposed examiners. That's been a difficulty for defense counsel and for proposed patients. What has occurred in the past is not so much a matter of there being, if you will, chicanery, but it doesn't give the proposed patient or his counsel much of an opportunity to present the necessary expert witness testimony so that the trier of fact can make, in fact, a determination based upon both parties having an opportunity to be heard. It's difficult when there are two examiners selected by the court, or at least appointed by the court, both of whom are presented, if you will, to the proposed patient, and rarely does a proposed patient under those circumstances have an opportunity to bring in his own doctor. These new rules would provide that opportunity for a respondent. The other thing that I would like to address is really kind of the flip side of that same coin, and that is in the course of the 60-day hearing. It is necessary for the proposed patient, or I should say by that time it's usually a committed patient, it is necessary for the committed patient under those at that particular time to have an opportunity to have an independent examination conducted by, hopefully, an examiner who is not a part of the treating staff in the hospital in which he's been kept and hopefully treated. I've had an opportunity to represent persons on the level of, in the proposed commitment hearing, and also in the course of the 60-day hearings, and also at the end of, I should say, at a period of time in which individuals are seeking to be released from indeterminate hospitalizations, for example, such as St. Peter State Hospital. In each of these areas, the respondent must have an opportunity to present independent medical testimony in his behalf. In some instances, that independent medical testimony will be in his favor. In other instances, it won't, but he must at least have the opportunity to make that showing. These rules, I would submit to you, provide that. Nothing more streamlined, to use Mr. McPeak's word, nothing more streamlined would help to establish the respondent's rights than these rules, and they should be kept as they are, and certainly in regard to these two provisions that I've spoken about this morning. Thank you.
Mr. Jeff Sparrett, a member of the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners, has asked to appear. Mr. Sparrett.
Morning, Your Honor. I'm Jeff Sparrett. I'm a member of the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners, and I'm also co-chairman of the Hennepin County Intergovernmental Relations Committee. For several years now, more than two in fact, Hennepin County has been actively involved in improving the procedures by which we administer the provisions of the Minnesota Hospitalization and Commitment Act, Chapter 253A. In the fall of 1979, the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners, along with Judge Peterson of the Hennepin County Probate Court and Thomas Johnson, Hennepin County Attorney, convened a task force to review commitment procedures and policies being followed in Hennepin County and to determine what modifications, if any, would be necessary. After prolonged and in-depth study, the task force developed an extensive set of recommendations for change by the county. These recommendations, which closely parallel those of the Minnesota Supreme Court Study Commission for the Mentally Disabled, have been adopted by the Hennepin County Board. These have also formed the primary basis of the consent decree of the Consolidated Federal District Court case of Vickerman et al. Versus Hennepin County Probate Court, Hennepin County Board of Commissioners et al. Hennepin County has implemented, or is in the process of implementing, these revised procedures. As a result of this experience, the board feels qualified to address the court with regard to the special proposed special rules which are the subject of this hearing. In general, Hennepin County both endorses the intent and content of these rules. For the most part, these rules closely correspond to our own revised procedures, and we believe that they have such significant due process implications that such procedures should be implemented throughout the state by Supreme Court rule insofar as possible within current statutes. Within the context of these general endorsements, there are a number of points and sections of the proposed rules to which the board specifically and strongly objects. Our first objection lies in section 10.02. We view these sections as problematical because they're much too specific, in our opinion, and they pose serious practical problems for implementation. The section does not allow for a phase-in of implementation of these policies, despite the fact that we would need to make a number of major system changes. These changes cannot be accomplished quickly due to potential construction and funding costs. It would have a significant adverse financial impact on the county due to the cost of meeting space requirements and a major increase in the need for security transportation by the Sheriff's Department. In Hennepin County, there are 17 hospitals and treatment facilities where respondents may be held or placed for evaluation pending commitment hearings. Although some hearings are held in courtrooms at the government center, most hearings have been held in these facilities. None of these facilities currently has space available, which meets the courtroom standards proposed in the special rules. The government center, which is the only possible alternative, cannot absorb the high volume of hearings now being held at these 17 other sites due to lack of sufficient courtroom space, lack of appropriate holding space for respondents, and the inability of the Sheriff's Department to transport such a large number of persons. It is expected that Hennepin County will continue to need multiple hearing sites, since no single site is available which can ever handle the entire projected volume of commitment hearings, and since probable cause hearings now place an additional demand on space. The government center courtrooms will continue to be utilized insofar as it is feasible, but the majority of hearings will still be need held at hospital sites. Most of these sites cannot be brought up to the requirements proposed under Section 10.02 standards, either because of the costs involved or the unavailable of adequate space, or both. At best, we anticipate that suitable hearing rooms, as defined by this section, could possibly be provided at two of the 17 hospitals and treatment centers, and then only after extensive remodeling at county expense. We could accomplish this task in 1 or 2 years. Within that same time period, and absent any further budgetary crises, the county expects to construct a similar hearing room at the Hennepin County Medical Center. Until this construction takes place, it's impossible for us to comply with Section 10.02. Furthermore, it is not even certain then that these measures would be sufficient to handle the volume and thus allow full compliance unless there were also modifications to Section 10.02. We recommend that first Sections 10.02, Paragraph 1 and Paragraph 2 should be made less specific. Our concern is here above all with the cost factor. We believe that fully adequate hearing sites can be provided at a sufficient number of locations and at a more reasonable cost if this section were made less directive. In particular, I suggest that the reference in Note B to the guidelines for Minnesota court facilities be stricken, since the construction of multiple hospital hearing rooms meeting the standards will be prohibitively costly for Hennepin County. Section 1.0.02.3 of paragraph 3 should be stricken as an unnecessary restriction on holdings of hearings in hospitals. As indicated before, space limitations in the government center mean that the majority of Hennepin County's hearings will probably be held in hospitals. Section 10.02, paragraph 3, would prohibit transporting a patient from one hospital to another for the purpose of holding a hearing, even though the second hospital's hearing room fully meets the requirement of the proposed special rules. Since transporting a patient from a hospital to a hearing room in government center is permitted under these rules, we cannot see an adverse negative impact on the patient by being transported from a hospital where there is not an adequate hearing room to a hospital where there is an adequate hearing room. We think that Section 10.02 should be modified also to allow for a phase-in of implementation of these procedures. Our second objection lies with Section 12.04. The note to this section of the proposed special rules mentions a possible problem regarding invasion of the principle of separation of powers. I'm certainly not learned in the law, but I do tend to agree with that note. County boards are authorized by statute to deliver a variety of services and to determine what the nature of those services shall be. We cannot strongly emphasize enough the difficult dilemma which such a rule poses for local legislative executive bodies, which must make public policy and spending decisions in a time when they're faced with severe levy limits and with declining state and federal funds to assist them in carrying out their mandates. In order to provide increased funding for mental health services, funds would have to be cut from other, presumably equally deserving, areas of service. To emphasize certain groups at the expense of others, when resources are limited as they are in this era, is a questionable benefit to the public good. It also renders it impossible for counties to set balanced budgets, which we must do as a matter of law. Hennepin County has already recognized that mental health services have historically been underfunded, and we started to take remedial steps. In a year when expenditures had to be cut below maintenance of effort level in many areas, the county board had budgeted for an 82% increase in mental health funds for 1982. This increase has come largely from local property tax dollars. It was not specifically called for by the Vickerman consent decree or any other mandate, but this resulted from an acknowledgement of past inequities. Nevertheless, Hennepin County strongly opposes the establishment of a court rule such as Section 12.04, which would give courts the power to enjoin local officials to make significant expenditures in the mental health or any other service area. We feel that if such public policy or spending decisions are to be made for the state of Minnesota, these decisions should be made by the legislature. In closing, I would like to reiterate the Hennepin County Board's overall support of these special proposed rules. At the same time, I would urge the court to give serious consideration to those few objections which we have raised and make revisions accordingly. I thank the court for this opportunity to be heard on behalf of the county.
Robert Orth, Chairman of the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, is asked to be heard.
please the court, I'm Robert J. Orth, chairman of the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners. I will shorten my presentation. Believe that a non-money matter, such as House File Number 1499, will be acted upon rather than something that might cost more money at the state level. The cost at the state level, however, is also a concern in terms of the legislation. Ramsey County feels that we would have a better opportunity to at least have the state share in the increased cost of these procedural rules if the legislature were to consider that matter while it adopts or amends the present act. Secondly, one of our concerns is the costs, increased cost of attorneys under the proposed rules. In Ramsey County, that is, these appeals from the initial commitment are presently being handled by our public defender's office. If these procedural rules were to be adopted, separate or other attorneys from the private sector would be required to be hired, and we feel that the cost would be increased without any substantial increase in the ability or the quality of defense to these clients. Secondly, the cost of examiners under Rule 7, we feel, is an unnecessary burden. The court develops a list of doctors. The respondents select one of the doctors, and the second doctor may be the suggestion of the petitioner. There's an additional burden involved with that under Rule 8 in that the examination shall not be conducted more than 7 days prior to the scheduled hearing, and each examiner has to prepare a separate report which is filed not less than 48 hours prior to scheduled commitment hearings. Presently, both attorneys are allowed to be present at the examination, and we would submit that the cost in this area would almost double under the proposed rules to the county without significant benefit to the person that we're dealing with. It has been stated earlier this morning by the proponent of these rules that the focus of these procedural rules is the liberty of the client. I would submit that there are some other equally important factors involved, the most important being treatment of people. As our costs go up on the county, it means, as a practical matter, that if we are forced through procedural rules to commit more monies in our budget to the hearing, we will have less money to commit for treatment if it has been determined that these people are in need of treatment. Secondly, it was also stated this morning, or the impression given, that the present two doctors who sit and make examinations at these hearings are not independent. They in fact are. In Ramsey County, the two doctors who are appointed by the court to examine various people who are subjected to commitment hearings are not doctors from the same hospital from which these people are resident, nor are they even doctors from the same hospital in which they are being temporarily held. Finally, in terms of hospital cost, we feel that that would also unnecessarily increase under these proposed rules. Under Rule 8, the stay of the respondent in the hospital for purposes of evaluation would increase, and the respondent's stay may be increased by as much as 4 to 5 days at a cost in Ramsey County at St. Paul Ramsey Hospital of $300 per day. It would also involve more transportation, which would be doubled or tripled, and which would be increased cost to the sheriff's office, which I would submit is not necessarily in the best interest of any client, whether they are found to be dependent or in need of treatment. That transportation back and forth can be a disruptive thing for anyone. Finally, under Rule 1204, the court may order the joinder of a governmental agency and order an alternative means of treatment. The rule does not take into account that in the case of Ramsey County, we have had alternative means of treatment within our community for the past 12 years. We are not, or were not, joined in the federal lawsuit against Hennepin County primarily for that reason. And I would submit, and I would not argue, that the judge has less ability to judge what is a good alternative for a client. I would submit that a judge has no more ability than the professionals on the county staff or within the community to determine what a proper alternative is. And as long as a county is providing those alternatives to treatment, I would submit that there is no need to go beyond the list of those alternatives. I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Orr. Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard on this particular matter? If so, please come forward. You want to take the microphone? These presentations are being taped, and if you'll address the microphone, we'll be sure to catch everything that's said.
Honorable judges, I'm Ray Daniels from Cass County up in Walker.
Could you speak up a little, even with the mic? I'm having trouble.
I'm Ray Daniels from Cass County, Minnesota. And I just wanted to, I don't have a list of the rules, so I won't comment specifically. However, as a representative of a small rural county, I'm a social worker. I work with the mentally ill. And I would just like to have the court keep in mind, in considering these things, that our county, as an example, does not have a psychiatrist, and we do not have a mental health center. And in fact, we do not have a hospital. And so we do have to, we do have part-time mental health services. So I'd just like to have this kept in mind as you deliberate. The second thing is just the, again, I'd like to reemphasize that with the proposed cutbacks in the federal and state funds and the difficulties this has provided the counties in dealing with and considering cutting back in various services and staff, I would like to just have you keep that in mind. And then the last thing that I would like to just voice, as having worked with mentally ill people for a number of years and been the social worker that has done the commitment, worked through the commitment process, I do object to the rule that talks about changing the place of the hearing from a hospital to a courtroom setting. I personally feel that this is one of the things that I have appreciated about the present system, is that it has been held in a hospital setting, and it has not subjected the proposed mentally ill person to the criminal type process of the formal court hearing. That's all I wanted to
say. Has your county board taken any official position on the rules?
No, they have not.
I take it, working for the county board?
I'm working for the county board, and I'm only representing myself. Yes.
Mr. Daniels, does your county, does Cass County participate in any regional mental health center? Are you a part of that kind of a service at all up there?
We have enlist the services of two regional mental health centers. Beltrami County's Upper Mississippi Mental Health Service Center provides part-time mental health services to the northern half of our county, and the is it the Northern Pines Mental Health Center at Little Falls provides a part-time staff once a week to the southern half of our county at this time.
The judge travels to those two facilities and conducts the hearings now, is that right?
The judge travels to Brainerd State Hospital to the hearings, yes. Unless we do have, there is one hospital room in the St. Joseph's Hospital at Park Rapids that they have held for primarily for Hubbard County people, but they will hold one of our patients, proposed patients, for a preliminary court hearing if they have that room available for a few days. But otherwise, Brainerd State Hospital is 60 miles from Walker, and that's where it's at.
Do they have hearing facilities there that would meet the proposed standards set forth in these rooms at Brainerd?
Not to my knowledge.
So that to comply with these, it would mean in a county such as yours, with the vast distances, that you'd be required to transport those patients all the way into the county seat in the courthouse and conduct the hearings, and then back to the hospital where they're being treated.
That is correct. Yes,
Your Honor. What facility is Agua Ching? What?
Agua Ching is a state nursing home.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Berman negligently creating a hazardous condition in the kitchen. And the thrust of the argument was that that somehow is an affirmative act on her part that takes the case out of the immunity rules. Well, I submit that even if that's true, that's no different than the father in the Urata case. There, according to a jury, he negligently either created or permitted to exist a dangerous condition that ultimately resulted in injury to one of his children. Nonetheless, this court very clearly said that that was still immune, so that I don't think it's any answer to the question to say that you negligently create a hazard and therefore the immunity cannot exist. You have to look beyond the fact of that and consider what kind of activity was involved. And in this case, Your Honors, it's very clear to me that this mother simply chose to use a fry cooker and chose to use it in a particular fashion on a particular day, and the unfortunate injury resulted. But nonetheless, under the teaching of the Cherry case and other cases, that constitutes a very clear exercise of ordinary parental discretion and is immune in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
This will be less than 60 seconds. I just had two comments on on Mr. Gillen's argument. First of all, the question of whether a reasonably prudent parent standard ought to be adopted. I suggest to the court that if the court wants to do that, all it's doing is making the child versus parent situation the same as it already has in the parent versus child in Baltz versus Baltz and in Baudet versus Frana, which is the husband versus wife. The question of whether whether imposing liability on this case will impose a new and heavy burden on Mrs. Berman and on other families suggests that the burden that is created by the injury and by the fact of the injury far outweighs any supposed burden that would be added by the fact of the litigation. Thank you.
Next case.